My name is Harrison Wheeler, and this is the Technically Speaking Podcast. I sit down with BIPOC designers, entrepreneurs, and technologists. We discuss careers, triumphs, and their resilience, and the why behind their decisions. Before we get started with the show, I just wanted to plug our Patreon. If you like what you're listening to and you want to support the podcast, for as low as $3, you can contribute monthly to help support the production of the show. You can contribute today by heading over to patreon.com/technicallyspeakinghw. I'll also include the link in the show notes. Today, I have the owner of Figure Eight Consulting, Natalie Nixon, on the show, joining us from Philly. Welcome. How are you doing this morning?
Hi, Harrison. I'm doing really greatly, especially because I've just gotten over COVID.
Oh, so what?
I'm doing really well.
Oh, no.
Yes.
I hope it was a mild case.
It was a mild case. It was my first bout with COVID. It felt like a bad flu for a day, yeah. Thankfully. I had Labor Day weekend to rest through it.
Yeah. So I was going to say, timing wise, at least it sounds good, but it's never a good time to get COVID.
No, it's not.
Yeah.
It's-
yeah. Well, hey, we're excited to have you on the show. You've got a really amazing history and you've been featured on so many publications for your amazing work. But before we get into that, I wanted to start out the show with some icebreakers. I do this with all of my guests. And some of the answers can lead to very interesting stories. So for the first question that I ask all my guests, what is something right now that you are currently obsessed with?
Reading more fiction. I grew up a library kid. My idea of a great afternoon when I was a little girl was just curling up the great book. And I was talking to my project manager and also my husband about this, I think because I did a PhD while working full-time, and I did it in 4 years. And I think I just got burned out from reading and realized about a year ago that while I do read nonfiction just to expand my own work and practice, I need to read more fiction. It's actually something I advise people to do to build their curiosity and their empathy. So I have dedicated myself to reading more fiction, and I'm going to be starting Isabel Allende novel. This isn't fiction, but it's certainly entertaining. I'm also almost finished Lenny Kravitz's memoir. Yeah. So I'm just really interested and looking forward to indulging in a very intentional way to quiet.
Yeah, I love that. I feel like there was a point where I got pretty obsessed with nonfiction. And it was like, oh, this feels like work. My time off. So
exactly.
Taking that back.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay. Another question that I have for you. What is something that you think doesn't get talked about enough?
Gosh, there are so many things. I think we are talking about in the current zeitgeist about burnouts and paying a lot of attention to the burn rate and of people's attempt to be productive in this very new way of working. But the part I don't think we're talking about enough of, which is the counterpoint to that, I guess there's a theme here, is the role of rest and the role of pausing and to understand that actually is not counter to being more productive, but in a very counterintuitive way. When we pause, when we step away, when we take time to nourish our minds, our body, our soul, in ways that may feel like you're lollygagging, feel like you aren't doing the air quotes important stuff. It is so essential. And that's what I don't think we're spending enough time talking about or allowing each other to.
Yeah. You know, that actually made me think about the concept or the construct around work-life balance, right? Because it's almost stated as that it needs to be an equilibrium when you're saying that's not the case, right?
No. And we also treat what we have is conversations about work-life balance. Embedded in those conversations are the dichotomy approach. There's work and then there's life. And I think that because so many more of us are working from home and there's a lot more blurred boundaries there, then the opportunities to think more about work-life integration, not in a way where you're burning out, but because I step over my threshold and I have a 5-second commute between my home office and my bedroom, I have to think more conscientiously about pausing and breaking in order to be more.
Yeah, I love that. And the 5-second commute. I think one thing I've always, at least I've been talking to folks about, especially as they start thinking about work, is not the idea of necessarily overemphasizing the value that you're going to bring to the job. What are the values and prioritizing in your life? And how might work play a role into that along, amongst many other things? So I think that's very relevant to like that idea. How have you been, handling that? Like you mentioned, like your office is right there, your owner. So how do you take care of all that?
I am a very kinesthetic person and learner. And I know this about myself combined with all the neuroscience research and creativity that we are designed to move. Mm. So I take daydream breaks. Mm. Which sometimes are 90 seconds long, sometimes they're 5 minutes long, and the prompts could be, right now it's a beautiful soft rain outside here in Philly, so just staring outside the window. It could be an ant crawling on the sidewalk, but it's not meditation. Meditation actually sometimes feels a bit more like work, because you have to keep telling yourself to focus and come back to nothingness or whatever. But daydreaming is actually allowing your mind to wander and to float. So that's one thing I do. I also have different sorts of timed walks in my neighborhood. So I know, and again, it's all budgeted throughout the day, right? So I know sometimes I can only afford a 5-minute walk. Other times I can afford a 20-minute walk. So I have these different pathways and routes so that I can walk. And if you read people like Thoreau, they talk so much about how so much, if you follow the 80-20 or the Pareto rule, probably 80% of productivity, they needed to be generative and to write and to reconnect ideas was through the walking, was through the sense making that we do, or ambling throughout the world. So that's another thing I do. I take regular short breaks. I'm also a lifelong dancer. I'm either in hip hop dance classes at the end of the days, or I'm in the ballroom studio. So ballroom is just amazing. So I dance. And that's another thing that actually helps me to, it's actually these nice rewards. I think we have to remember that we have to incentivize ourselves and celebrate when we finish a long jaunt of work and have something to look forward to.
Yeah, I love that. Thank you for breaking that down for us. I love that idea of daydreaming. And the first thing I kept in mind is like the thoughts you have while not only walking, but even in the shower, right? Like those moments play a really big role in the creative process. All right. So last icebreaker, and I know I'm going to put you on the spot. You mentioned something around classic and hip hop dance. What do you listen to?
Oh, right now, our kitchen on the Alexa app, I'm listening to John Coltrane. And also shout out to Philly, which is where I'm from. Yeah. That's just where John Coltrane was from. I love pop music. I love Dua Lipa. Mm. I love Megan Thee Stallion. I don't know a ton about rap, although I am of the generation that birthed rap and hip hop. I think that Megan Thee Stallion is, in my opinion, one of the best rappers out here right now. I love the way she rhymes and syncopates and listen to her voice. And I'm also a big acid jazz devotee. So I like Massive Attack. I like Everything But the Girl. Yeah. I like that kind of flow.
I love that. So that's actually a very eclectic playlist. I feel like I asked this to a number of our guests. I feel like I should do like a technically speaking playlist. You're actually
that would be a great idea.
You're actually the second person who's had Coltrane on his list. So
it'd be cool if someone designed and developed a SoundCloud version.
Yeah.
Well, maybe that's a SoundCloud. No, sorry. You know, there's word clouds.
Yeah.
If you input all the conglomeration of all the songs that your guests have been saying, then certain songs are going to get greater hit concentration. Yeah. And that would be a cool way to generate a music playlist.
Yeah, I would love that. There could be some scientific research behind it. This activates the creative part of your brain. You know, who knows? Maybe.
Yeah.
We can try it out one of these days. All right. So let's get into the show. I want to get to know a little bit more about you. I love like this quote, but it says, you are known as the creativity whisperer in the C-suite. Take us through what that means and how does creativity play a role at an executive level in your mind?
For too long, creativity has not played a conscientious role at the executive level. And that has a lot to do with the ways that people who get to the C-suite have been educated. Mm. So if they've been educated in a way like through an MBA program or through law school or something like that, then we have very binary ways of thinking about management, about thinking about leadership. And we forget that at the end of the day, organizations are organisms. Mm-hmm. And they're organisms because they're made of humans who are imperfect, inconsistent, and not predictive. And so from my perspective, as I was at the beginning years of building figure eight thinking, getting invited into companies to help them build cultures of innovation, which sometimes was turning into innovation theater or it wasn't really sustained, I landed on this idea that we were starting in the wrong place, that we actually need to start with creativity in order to design sustainable innovation systems in the ways that we work. The challenge, of course, is that I really couldn't, in those days, really lead with creativity because people thought, I'm actually hear people say, oh, I'm not creative because I can't fill in the blank, paint, sing, draw, act, dance. Yeah. Or I would overhear murmurings like, oh, the creatives, air quotes, the creatives will take care of it, you know, when we're done the real important work in paren, right? So the important work is the strategy work, the financial modeling, the regression analysis, all that stuff. And the creatives tended to be designers or people in marketing and that sort of thing. And what I instinctively knew to be true is that creativity is something that artists are exceptional at exhibiting and working through. But the best engineers and coders and accountants and lawyers are super creative. Now, this is the definition I've landed. I didn't have the language then 5 years ago, but that's what I write about a lot in the creativity lead. The best of all of those folks are super creative when they're doing this toggling between wonder and rigor to solve problems. So especially now where we are 3 years out from the beginnings of the COVID-19 pandemic, there will be another interruption and massive disruption. So we need to build a capacity within ourselves and in terms of how we're building organizational culture that's much more adaptive, that is doesn't need a script, but is okay with playbook. Right. And so that is what building a creative capacity in my work with leaders.
Yeah, I love that. Well, we'll get into that a little bit more too, because I have a lot of questions around what kind of goes into like that creative practice for these different types of roles. But maybe give us like a brief background about you and how you got to where you are today.
I have a really diverse and loopy background. I have a background in cultural anthropology and fashion. And by the time I hit my 30s, I finally was okay with not fitting into a particular lane. I really struggled with that definitely throughout my 20s, where I felt the need to be able to say, I like this silo and I'm only, that's what my focus is. But I've really always thrived in multidisciplinary spaces. I think my music playlist also reflects that. And I have a background where anthropology equipped, cultural anthropology specifically, really equipped me with a way to ask questions, to observe people. I'm African American, Gen Xer from the East Coast of the United States, from Philly. And so I grew up in a way where I also had to be deeply observant, because by the time I was in fourth grade, I was being educated in environments where I was typically the only one, one of a few. And for those of us who find ourselves on the margins like that, you get really astute at A, making other people comfortable with you, and B, being a really keen observer of human behavior. So it was a blessing in disguise that I went through those social experiences that were sometimes challenging, but it really cultivated in me a capacity to be curious about other people and to be deeply observant about them. Coupled with my training in cultural anthropology, it was like whammo, it was just dynamite. And then my background in fashion is something that has people who have never worked in fashion either think fashion is glamorous or they think it's frivolous. And it's neither. Fashion is a business, and it really taught me to appreciate having a financial acumen, appreciate the role of logistics and tech, because I worked as both an entrepreneurial hat designer, then I worked in global sourcing for a division of limited brands. Then took me to live and work in Sri Lanka, Portugal, making bras and panties for the Victoria's Secret account. And the other thing that fashion taught me is to really appreciate the development of when you're building consumer insight to understand the role of beauty and desire and aesthetics, which healthcare forsakes, tech often forsakes, financial services doesn't get, we're motivated as humans not only by solo, but we're motivated by desire and beauty and aesthetics. So those sorts of things I carry forward into my work. I was a professor for 16 years and I was a very entrepreneurial academic. So the first 10 years I taught the business of fashion, and the last 6 years I created and launched an executive MBA program called the Strategic Design MBA that integrated design thinking, how people learn strategy, leadership, branding, finance, etc. And I started my company, so you're thinking, as a side hustle in 2015 and then looked up a year later and realized I was having more fun with my side hustle. And by 2017, I decided to resign from academia, have not looked back. Wow. And what's amazing and special about this moment in my life and my work is that all of those divergent threads have now converged to be super helpful. Yeah.
Was that something that you were consciously working towards, or was it like once you had your agency, you're like, oh snap, like,
It's more of a snatch. I went to Kashi. I've never had a 5-year plan or a 10-year plan. I really have built my work around following my intuition and acting on it, even when it's terrifying. Yeah. So it really, you know, what I always recommend to people is to prototype that thing that you think you're really interested in. And what by having figure thing as a side hustle for a good 2 years, I was really prototyping and learning what I'm actually good at, what I'm not so good at, what do clients actually need? How do I figure that out? And so by the time I decided to move on from academia, I had built a reputation. I had burgeoning small, but burgeoning practice. And I was able to offer something that was, that was pretty
unique. Spoke about intuition, right? And I want to connect the dots here. Would you say you gain more confidence in your intuition through practice of some of these ideas that you had over time? Or is this just something you're like, you know what, I'm going to blindly follow?
I think there's been different practices in my life that have helped me to be brave about following my intuition. So I've already referenced dance, and dance is an art form, requires you to be deeply embodied and to pay attention to how you feel, to pay attention to your effect on others. And so that already was helping me to be aware of it. And because I'm actually quite uncomfortable with linear 5-year plan.
Yeah.
So my fallback was to really sit with my intuition. Now, that doesn't mean that the answer, the signal was always super bright and loud and clear. All of us know that the way intuition works is sometimes it can be quite murky. The cool thing about intuition is that it's like a sonar, it's like a muscle, it's like a radar. So the more we use it, the stronger and clearer it gets. And so for me, it was much more a kind of, I just love this idea of sense making. It felt like someone was groping in the dark and finding my way through, but I would really pay attention to those signals. I would pay attention to what people seem to be. I'll give you an example. The way I define creativity as toggling between wonder and rigor to solve problems, I tinkered with these ideas for it was really over a 3-year period of time that I was building out this ecosystem of creativity in the way that I now explain it. And the way I would start, in terms of the way I would use my intuition, is I would have a meeting at a Fortune 500 company, and I was very self-conscious about what I'm taking seriously and making sure I sounded impressive enough. But I also wanted to understand like what this potential client's appetite would be for this body of work that I would want to experiment on with them in a collaborative, co-creative way. And so I would always be initially at the last 5 minutes of the meeting, and I would say something like, there is this other approach that I've been using with some of my other clients, which was a lie at that time, where we've been exploring these ideas around wonder and rigor. And I would just see their body language shift. They would relax. They would lean into the table. They would say, what do you mean by that? Or say more about that. Oh, that reminds me of XYZ. And that's when I started knowing I was on to something. I wasn't brave or courageous enough. I wouldn't lead with it initially because it would just sound so wonky and wonder. Who talks about wonder in the C-suite? Yeah. But now that I've built a body of work that connects the dots between creativity and business ROI, I am able to lead with it. But that's an example of how we have to intuit our way forward and making sure things
stick. Well, take us through your agency. So it's called Figure Eight. One, how did you get the name? And two, what are the types of projects that you tend to work on?
Yes, it's called Figure Eight Thinking. and I got the name in kind of a thunderbolt way. My husband, John, is an attorney, and he is an executive compensation attorney and started out as an ERISA tax benefits law guy. And he was the one actually who first encouraged me to formalize my side hustle. Because he was like, Nat, this is like a thing. Like, you keep getting invited to do these projects. I was like, yeah, I don't know. He was like, you should formalize it. I was like, okay. And finally, he was like, listen, I keep asking what's going to be the name. I have to go in tomorrow and I want to finish your LLC work. And I was going back and forth between different names and ideas. But I landed on Figure Eight Thinking, number one, because I've already mentioned that I'm a very kinesthetic learner. Mm-hmm. And Figure Eight is about movement, if you think about ice skating. I also liked what building a figure eight connotes. It's about the build. It's about revisiting an idea, building out, and then coming back. I like that. Very integrative. And the word thinking, maybe figure eight probably was already taken. But the word thinking, it's so interesting how I was a bit shy about. I was a slowly recovering academic. And I know that it's a 50-50 chance you've got that some people are impressed with a PhD and some people incorporate, oh, PhDs. What do they know about real life? But I now fully embrace and own that one of my superpowers is my ability to help people who are stuck or in kind of laggard industries rethink about the way they think, to think about the way they think. And the reason that matters is because so many people in their work are churning. Yeah. They never pause to really think about the way they're thinking. And if you don't pause to think about the way you've been thinking about an opportunity or a challenge, you will never reframe. And if you never reframe, you'll never actually innovate. You'll never either incrementally or exponentially, right? So what I go in and do is to help people think differently so that they can behave differently and that eventually there's culture change. So the figure eight thinking piece is that's what's all wrapped up in that.
I love that. And what is the type of work that you're doing when you're working with your clients?
So the primary work that I've started, there's two streams of my work. One is global keynote speaking and the other is advisory work. And in the keynote speaking, I'm getting hired across sectors around the world to do two things, to re-energize and invigorate with new mental models and to leave people with practical ways that they could start to implement what I'm sharing around future of work, around new ways of teaming, new ways of working in these hybrid modern offices, whatever the topical areas, ways they could implement what I'm sharing about by the end of the day, the next day, by the end of the week. In my advisory work, there are two streams of the advisory work. So one is, I love ambiguity. Yeah. I love helping strategic leadership teams figure out what's our next, what's our purpose, what's the business that we should be in versus the business we've been churning in. And so I design foresight studios for strategic leadership teams to help them think through those sorts of questions again, to give them a very strategic way to think about the way they've been thinking. And we literally, in the way I design these foresight studios, we go through a lot of wonder and we also converge into a lot of rigor. So I always like to gift my clients with an actionable roadmap. Yeah. Okay, what's it going to take for us to operationalize this, to make this real? What are the people, the processes, the situations that we need to be considering? And what needs to be in budget and newer refurbished skill sets that we need to activate to make this happen? And so what needs to be placed tomorrow? What's one thing we can start doing tomorrow, a week from now, month from now, to the next quarter? So the way that I have built out these frameworks is also the way I like to design these foresight studios. And that's kind of a B2B level. On a B2C level, when people as individuals come to me when they're feeling a bit stuck, and this could be in a work-related challenge that they're having. It could also, sometimes it's a bit more personal. And we know now that the personal and professional are blurred. I have pick my brain sessions. So those are the two ways that I help people, is through the speaking and it's through the advisory work. And the questions are always this variation of a theme around getting people through these very ambiguous moments, getting organizations through these very ambiguous moments.
Another thing that you have is your book called The Creativity Leap. Maybe give the listeners a brief overview about that and what motivated you to do that. Is that kind of an extension of the work that you do now?
It definitely is. So The Creativity Leap came out in 2020, and the subtitle is unleash curiosity, improvisation, and intuition at work. And the basic premise of the book is that creativity is not a nice to have, not woo-woo. Creativity is a must have. And I then go on to explain why and then how. So every chapter concludes with very practical ways that you can act on some of the ideas that I go through in the chapter as an individual, but also at work with your team. And I wrote the book because as a speaker, I really use my keynotes to prototype ideas. Right. And as I was prototyping this new way of figuring out how to do the advisory work of building the creative capacity of leaders, I would prototype these concepts and these frameworks in my speaking. And people would come to me at the end of the talks and say, that was great. Where can I read more about that? And which I got enough of those prods at the end of the keynote, I was like, okay, I need to write about this in one centralized location. So that was the big push for writing the
creativity. Yeah. And you also have a supplementary LinkedIn course that goes into to some of that as well. And shout out to LinkedIn.
To LinkedIn. I was really excited. I was really impressed with the production help and support I got because I did the whole recording in my home office with my project manager. So it was all virtual and I'm really just
So how did you get into that whole sort of LinkedIn learning course and maybe take us through what a production like that is?
The way that I got into being invited to develop a LinkedIn course is because Jesse Hempel, who hosts a LinkedIn podcast called Hello Monday, interviewed me during the launch period of my book, The Creativity, and circled back to me about a year later and said, I think that your content is really rich. So I think it would be really great if you talk to some of our folks at LinkedIn Learning to develop a course. And I said, that would be amazing. Thank you so much for recommending me. And nothing much happened. And a few months passed by. And then I got a follow-up from Allison Hanke at LinkedIn Learning. And she has been amazing. I guess she's my content. I forget all the technical names that LinkedIn uses, but she's been my Sherpa.
Yeah.
She's been my guide. And we landed on the name of my course is Lead with Inquiry, Improvisation, Intuition, because she really liked my 3I model, which is inquiry, improv, and intuition. And she thought that would be a very practical and helpful way to help people act on and activate and operationalize what I talk about in terms of creativity.
I love that. And one of the things that I really get out of this is all of your experiences have really culminated into everything that you do. Like you can even see it in terms of the 3 I's, right? That in dance, you talk about like the intuition that you've developed over time. And obviously a big part of design and the creative process is really being able to inquire and asking those questions and be curious. So it's amazing just kind of how those are foundational to being successful, not only within the creative field, but throughout.
Exactly. Yes. As my mom used to tell us as we were growing up, all learning is interconnected. You know, everything that we do, whether it's waiting tables or leading a team, it's relevant and we can interweave it into our current work.
Look, is there any sort of advice that you want to leave for the listeners before we wrap up on the show?
I just want to encourage people to bring a full circle back to the top of our conversation, Harrison, to give themselves the permission to pause so that they can regenerate and truly flourish in their work. Our brains need it. Our bodies need it. We need time. Our neural synapses don't come alive only in the frontal neocortex. There's all these really groovy, deeper recesses of the brain that only get activated when we're not doing that full cognitive load, but we're allowing ourselves to take in the environment. So that's what I want to encourage people to do.
Yeah. How can folks find you on the internet?
They can find me by going to figure8thinking.com. That's FIGURE, the number 8. thinking.com. And they can follow me on LinkedIn and also start checking out my Fast Company articles. I'm a new-ish contributor to Fast Company magazine.
So we'll also add writing to that amazing list of talents that you have. And for the folks listening, we'll include these links in the show notes and in the description. But Natalie, thank you so much for coming on the show and in sharing your wisdom and your practice. Excited for folks to really dig in. And I might get that book for my team, actually.
Oh, I would be so grateful for that. And I would love to hear what the response is. And I'll send you a discussion guide. And if you ever want to circle back with your team on that, let me know. Thank you so much for having me on your podcast. It's a real pleasure.
Well, that concludes the show. Thank you so much for listening. Don't forget to leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. That is a huge way to show your support, and it really helps us reach more people and grow our following. By the way, we release a new episode every 2 weeks, but in the meantime, you can follow us on Instagram, LinkedIn, or YouTube at Technically Speaking HW. Again, thanks so much, and I'll see you next time. This has been a production of Technically Speaking Media.